I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of May 2nd, 2014. On the show this week, what happens when she makes more? A conversation about the rise of female breadwinners. And this is the time of year when kids and parents are trying to figure out how to pay for college. We've got tips, even if you haven't saved a single dollar. But we're going to start with big data, the stuff that tracks our digital moves. This week, a White House panel called for more privacy protections, and here to talk about it is the host of Marketplace Tech, our own Ben Johnson. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So what did this White House panel say?
Well, the panel tells us that a lot of our policies now, of course, are a decade old when it comes to online privacy. And the report is hoping to sort of take a look at what the current situation is with data collection and whether or not policies address the current way that data is collected on users. Now, the good news is the White House got a lot of things right in identifying the problem. It looked closely at how companies are collecting our data from, like, big companies, Google, Facebook, to third-party companies, marketing agencies, stuff like that. The scary thing is that some of the data being collected on our behavior could be used by companies to make judgments about, say, our ability to pay a mortgage or buy a car or our job performance or what our health is like. And I think the White House did a good job of sort of identifying the problem.
Now, the irony here, of course, is we're not talking about the NSA. We're talking about private companies.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Not the government.
But
what are companies tracking? You know, if you're just talking about me online, what do they see?
You would be amazed. Companies track so many different little bits of data about you. This week, I talked to a woman, Janet Vertesi. She's a sociologist studying science and technology at Princeton. She tried to hide her entire pregnancy from marketers online over 9 months. She said no messages from her friends or her family on Facebook, Twitter, anything like that. No emails. She actually got in a fight with a relative over a private Facebook message because the relative didn't realize Facebook reads private messages. She used anonymizing tools to hide whenever she visited WebMD, for instance, to answer a question about the pregnancy, or Amazon to look at stuff to buy for the baby. And she found it was really hard to keep the pregnancy quiet, even for a short-term period.
But, I mean, there are some benefits to, I guess, data tracking as well, right? I see offers that are customized to me. Things can be cheaper. There's a flip side to this.
Absolutely. And that's the argument that marketers would make. You know, but it's more than a web page just serving you an ad for shoes you looked at the other day. For instance, I use a lot of Google products like Gmail. I have a Nexus 5 phone, which has this thing called Google Now, which delivers you all this like relevant information according to the data, of course, that Google collects on you. I went to Austin recently. Google knew my flight information and kept me updated the day before. It told me when to leave for the flight. When I got there and got my rental car, it told me how to get to all the places I had gone the last time I was in Austin. And this, here's the scary part. It quickly identified my behavior. And the entire time I was in Austin, it delivered me like pertinent information. If I was going to work, it would tell me in the morning how to get to work. If I was leaving work, it would tell me how to get to the next place I was going. It pulled all this stuff from my email and my behavior, which is pretty a little scary.
Okay, let's say someone listens to this and says, nuh-uh, too much. I want to opt out.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, it can get complicated, right? There's different kinds of services. Ghostery is one. It's this browser app that shows you how you're being tracked online in real time and lets you sort of surf the web and try and customize your own privacy needs. Janet Vertesi, that woman I talked to, she used this tool called Tor, which sort of anonymizes your online surfing. But it gets pretty complicated. Let me just give you a little peek at the future. Your television knows when you eat ice cream and knows what's in your fridge and reminds you to eat the ice cream in your fridge and maybe gives you a coupon.
That's terrifying. Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
The This is Marketplace Money from APM. We're now more than 5 years out from the depths of the financial crisis, and the very nature of banks has changed a lot. Many have gotten bigger, and it can be hard if you're just a regular person with a checking account to make sure that your money is working for you in the best way. John Wasik just wrote about banking abuses for Forbes. He's a contributor there and also the author of Cain's Way to Wealth. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote about some common bank abuses that you've seen. Tell us about them.
Well, what drives me nuts are prepaid debit cards. Essentially, these are cards loaded with money. You can use them anywhere, but they're charging you to get at your money. They often have service fees. They charge you for looking at balances. I mean, some of the fees are just obnoxious. So you have to be really careful with that. And in many cases, if you can find a no-fee checking account, that's the best deal. There's a lot of online banks that are very, very inexpensive, but the key is no fee.
In terms of these fees, what are we talking about? I mean, are we talking $5, $100? How big of a bite do they take?
Well, according to Bankrate, the average for what they call an NSF fee, and that's an overdraft fee, per occurrence is around $34, and that's across the country. So every time you're overdrawn, they're going to nail you for that amount. And then there's other little fees, like when you go to an ATM that's out of network, that's around $2.50, $3, depending on where you're going. If you're overseas, it's more like $5.
Why is all of this happening now? After all, we had this financial crisis. It seems like, shouldn't the banks be on better behavior now?
One would think, after the huge subsidies that they received from our very generous taxpayers.
Yeah.
But banks are more interested in managing big money these days. They want to do wealth management. They want to sell you annuities. They want to give you a big financial plan. They focus on their trading desks to make money. They focus on wealth management services to bring in the big bucks. And the least of it is doing checking accounts and basic banking stuff that just about everybody used to do. So in the last couple of years, they've been raising the fees quite a bit. And if you just need a basic service, it's getting to be pretty expensive.
Do you think it's worth it to switch to a credit union or a smaller bank or an online bank to move away from a Goliath-type bank here?
I think so. I think the trend is that if you go small, if you look at your local credit union, if you consider an online banking agreement, which is mostly all electronic transfers, you could save quite a bit of money on the nickel and dime stuff that they really nail you with.
The flip side of this argument is that a big bank would say, well, with us you get scale, maybe the ability to get a good home mortgage or to get one of their other products that you might not have if you have a small bank. What do you say to that?
I don't think that's true, because you can find a mortgage online. You can go through a broker. I don't think there are any advantages with being with a big bank anymore. You can really get a better rate of interest if you shop around. I have an online money market account, and I've never seen any banker connected with it. So I do all my transfers electronically, and it works fine.
What about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? This new agency was created to, you know, speak out on behalf of you and me.
Well, they have been doing quite a bit, but their portfolio is pretty huge. They look at college debt. They look at credit cards. They look at mortgages. You can go to their website and complain about some of these things, and they might just respond to you, but the best way is for you to shop around and get a better deal.
What are some resources for shopping around and finding the best deal?
Well, one of my favorite resources is Bankrate.com. You go online, you can not only find some of the best deals in checking, but you can find what passes for high-yield savings these days. And it just takes a couple of minutes to find these services. And if you just simply put into a search engine, no-fee checking, you'll find a lot of banks that are more than willing to take your business.
You've written about binding arbitration. What is that, and how do banks protect themselves by using binding arbitration?
Well, basically, this is an agreement that says if you agree to take our services, you also forfeit your right to sue them over something that involves a dispute. This is very common in the brokerage business. In fact, you really can't sue them at all. So you sign away your rights. So you really have to know what that means. And if you're not doing any big transactions, it's probably no big deal. But they all require you to sign these agreements, and they're kind of insidious.
How do you go about guarding against this? Where should you look to make sure that, say, you don't get hit with an overdraft line of credit, for example?
Well, the devil's in the details. In this case, it's always in the fine print. So if you get just a basic description of services, you have to look at this very carefully. Overdrafts are $30 plus, unless you get like a line of credit and you can save a little bit of money. You can get like $10 transfer fees instead of getting nailed with $30. So you have to know what kind of person you are when you're doing this kind of banking. Do you need a lot of transfers? Do you need to do a lot of debit card things? Do you need to do ATM transactions? And there's lots of ways to save money. You just have to keep your eye on the details.
John Wasik is the author of Cain's Way to Wealth and a contributor to Forbes and Reuters. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Next on the show, Luis Barajas joins me to answer your money questions. And later, more and more women are becoming the breadwinners of the family.
There are a lot of complexities, unique ones, facing couples with this particular financial dynamic that go unspoken, and I wanted to sort of bring them to surface.
Farnoosh Torabi joins us to do just that. That's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. And here's the part of the show where we take your calls and puzzle through your money questions. And joining me today is certified financial planner Luis Barajas. Hi, Luis.
Hi, Lizzie. How are you?
I'm good. It's nice to have you back.
Thank you.
We are going to turn to our first caller, who is Marcia in Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Marcia.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Tell us what you're thinking about, what your financial dilemma is.
Okay. I am 63. And I'm a retired high school teacher, 34 years, and I've been retired, it'll be 2 years in May, and I have a question about what to do. I'm considering starting a Roth IRA for my 9-year-old granddaughter's college. I have a pension, I have Social Security on my ex-husband who is dead now, so I get a lot more money from him. And I have a part-time job I'm a church musician, and I love doing it, so I'm keeping that job. My house is paid for. I have 23 more payments on my Honda Accord, and I'll probably pay that off early like I did my mortgage. And I just didn't know where to put some extra money. You know, I'd like to have that for her. If something happens to me, my family's fine. My family's fine. You know, I've got, you know, life insurance, and they'll just inherit my house, and, you know, there's money and things like that. But I was just wondering about a Roth IRA.
Well, let me ask you, before we get to your granddaughter, give me a ballpark figure on your retirement security, because I just want to get a better sense of what you've got set aside. And do you know how much is in those retirement accounts you've got?
Well, my retirement is through the state of Tennessee, the consolidated retirement. I do have a separate tax-sheltered annuity. It's about right at $60,000. And I know I can't start using that till I turn 70 and a half. But my pension and my Social Security, you know, that's not going to change.
How much do you have that you would like to invest for your granddaughter?
Well, I think I could actually do between $300 and $500 a month.
Wow.
Well, I mean, I'm I don't have any debt. You know, my expenses are covered. I'm doing okay.
You sound like a very loving and also very prepared grandmother.
Well, I worked really hard to get the house, to get everything paid for, you know, when I plan to retire at 62. So it just, everything fell in place. So I'm very grateful that it's worked out this way.
Let me turn you over to Lewis, because I bet he has some thoughts about what's the right vehicle to put that money away for your granddaughter.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Marcia. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. And it sounds like you've done a great job. But I'm going to back up just a little bit, because you mentioned, while Lizzie was asking you some questions, you mentioned a couple of things that maybe there might be some confusion on.
Okay.
So what happened is that you have a tax-sheltered annuity, a TSA, that you probably had while you were a teacher, and that you said that you can't start pulling the money out until you're 70 and a half?
Right.
Okay, so the confusion there is that usually you can pull your money out after 59 and a half without incurring any penalties.
Okay.
So you can start pulling the money out without incurring any penalties if you need the cash. The other thing is that at 70 and a half, you have to take out what's called a requirement minimum distribution. And it's really important that you pay attention to that. The only reason I'm telling you that is that a lot of people forget, and the penalty for not putting money into, if you actually had like in an IRA, there's a 50% penalty on the amount that you don't withdraw,
okay,
that you need to withdraw. So, and you don't have to pull all the money out at 70 and a half. It's just a actual table that you have with the IRS, and you'll pull a certain amount every year. The other thing is, have you also completed a trust just in case you want to transfer the home that you have to your children if something were to happen to you, to avoid any kind of probate issues?
That's on my to-do list. Okay, I've thought about it, but I haven't actually done it yet.
So I've always wanted to say this.
You guys are having like a mind.
So I've always wanted to say this, right? Marcia, you need to not procrastinate on the trust in the will of anybody who's listening to us. So that's probably one of the most important things. So use some of the money that you're going to have available for you to do that right away.
Okay.
Especially if you love your children and you want to leave some assets to your grandchildren as well.
Okay.
So let's go back to the college funding for your granddaughter. What a wonderful idea. But the Roth IRA is actually not the best thing for your granddaughter. What you want to really take a look at when you're looking at college funding for any child is a Section 529 plan.
Okay.
And so on the Section 529 plan, every state, it doesn't really matter which state 529 plan you use, but you're in Tennessee, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so if you go to TNstars.com, that's the college savings plan for the state of Tennessee. It's a Section 529 plan, and you can invest as little as $25. Now, here's the wonderful thing. You have control over those assets, but you're going to name your granddaughter as a beneficiary. Now, if for some reason down the road your daughter has another child and your first grandchild rebels and doesn't want to go to college, you can transfer that 529 plan to another child. Or even if your kids want to go back to college, you can use that money for that as well. And also, in those funds, the costs of the mutual funds that you're going to use are extremely low. The other thing is that just in case you don't know which investments to select while you're doing the 529 plan, you can select one of those age-weighted plans, which meaning that you select your granddaughter's age, and I think it was like 9 years old, or she's got 9 years left before she goes to college. Pick one that's between, you know, it'll tell you how old is your granddaughter, 9 years old, and they'll manage the funds for you based on her age and how many years we have left to go before you're going to use the money, if you want to simplify things.
Okay.
So those are just kind of three core issues we want to go back to is, again, get that trust done, do a 529 plan, do it through the state of Tennessee. And then again, keeping control of the assets, because the last thing you want to do is also give money to a child and have her control it as soon as she turns 18.
Oh, no, no,
don't. We don't want to do that.
No, we learned about that already. Well, you just got a plan.
That's right.
Like I said, I'm grateful. I feel, you know, very blessed, and you've helped me a whole lot. Thank you.
Awesome.
Your granddaughter is lucky to have someone like you who is thinking about her and thinking ahead in this way. You know, college is expensive. She's really going to appreciate it.
Well, she's wonderful. She's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for answering my questions.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Sure. Bye.
All right, Lewis, can you stick around and answer another call on the other side of this break?
I'd love to.
I'm back now with certified financial planner Luis Barajas to answer more of your calls. Our next caller is Grant in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Grant.
Hello.
How's it going?
Great. How are you?
Good. So my understanding is that you are in the process of purchasing or thinking about purchasing an apartment, but also looking at a master's program. Those are two things that would require big chunks of change. Tell us your story.
Yes. So I'm currently a teacher, a public school teacher, and I'm about to close on a co-op in Brooklyn. And I've been thinking about going, I've been accepted to go to a master's program in actuarial science, and considering changing careers in the next few years to be an actuary. And mm-hmm. so I've thinking about how to pay for the master's program. And I'm balancing how much I should take out in loans and if I should put less into retirement to try and pay more of the tuition up front now.
Tell us what you've already got in retirement and kind of where you're pretty young. So you've got time on your side, which is a great thing.
Yeah, I'm pretty young. I'm 27. And so far I've been putting about $5,000 a year into Roth IRA. So I have about $15,000 in a Roth IRA. I'm in my second year as a teacher, and I have about $15,000 in my tax-deferred annuity and another $5,000 in the qualified pension plan retirement. So altogether, probably about like $35,000 in retirement. I have a lot in retirement and I do have time, and I was wondering if I should start putting less in now, and cut that down, and how much I should cut that down to see if I should just try and pay for as much of the tuition, up front now instead of taking out, a federal student loan.
And how much is this master's program going to cost you?
It's going to be about, $10,000 a semester. So $20,000 each year, plus some extra fees.
Have you looked at loans and what sounds good, what doesn't sound good, you know, how much funding you would get?
Yeah, I was looking at the federal Stafford loans, which is the only federal loan that I could qualify for. And I could qualify for up to $20,000 a year, that could cover the entire cost. I don't want to take out the full amount. I think I want to try and pay at least half. But I think I might be able to swing a little bit more if I put less into retirement, but I'm not sure about if I should do that. And I haven't looked into any private loans.
I'm gonna let Luis kind of walk you through this. And I just have one more question, though. In your apartment purchasing, have you already paid the closing costs, etc.? Has that gone out the window? Down payment, closing costs, all that?
Half the down payment has, and I need to put the other half of the down payment I need to put in, and the closing costs I haven't paid yet, but it's probably going to be not too much. But that also will leave me with not that much emergency funds.
Luis, what do you think of Grant's situation and this question of how much he should take out in loans?
Grant, first of all, if I didn't know your age, I think you'd probably be like in your mid-30s, 40s, early 40s, and you're only 27. So first of all, kudos to you. You are going to be one of the wealthiest people in New York in the next 20 years, especially the way your mindset is already geared towards saving money. But because you're changing careers, and hopefully you've thought about changing careers, not for the aspect of just making more money, but because you love that career, because otherwise, you know, it's part of that whole process of when you're thinking about moving from being a teacher to an actuary. I mean, we're talking about something totally different.
Totally different.
Night and day different. So keep that in mind, because I deal with a lot of money and life issues, and I want to make sure that at the end of your life, you know, you've thought about that, aligned your money with some level of significance. So you're going to be working while you're going to school?
Yeah.
Let's just clarify that. Okay.
Yeah.
So what I'd like to do is for you to start saving some money outside of your retirement plans and continue saving through the retirement plan, because you're still going to be teaching, correct?
Yeah.
So you are part of the New York, the STRS program, the New York State Teachers Retirement Program?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what happens, there's automatically taking a certain percentage out of your paycheck and going into that pension plan.
Mm-hmm.
So what you might want to do instead of the Roth IRA contributions in the meantime, and again, I'm saying this because, again, he has money still going into his retirement plan, is maybe move it out into a regular brokerage account and start saving the money outside that becomes liquid or available to you in a few more years, when you may want to use that to start paying down some of the debt that you're going to use. Now, Lizzie, what people don't know is that Stafford loans are wonderful loans, but they can be either subsidized or unsubsidized.
Exactly.
And so subsidized means that while you're in school, the government is paying for all the interest on those loans, and then you start paying the interest 6 months after you graduate or go to a part-time status,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And I think the interest rate right now is around 3.9, 3.86, somewhere around there, fixed. So I mean, those are great loans, and in the meantime, while you're going to school, it's taking a little bit to get through, you can have that money invested, and if you're not paying any interest on it, well, you know, maybe you'll have a lot more money saved up to start paying down some of those loans, because you're going to be using the government's money while you're investing your money. You can do that.
Mm-hmm.
If it's unsubsidized, you're going to start accruing interest right off the bat. And again, those unsubsidized loans tend to have interest rates that are higher.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we want to take a look at it, how much you're going to be paying in those loans, whether they're subsidized, unsubsidized. And then what we want to do is also have some liquidity. So whether you say, should I just save some now and start paying as much as I can and take out the minimum or the least amount in loans, or just, you know, save as much money, put it in mutual funds, get it growing, put it in a portfolio, and then wait till I'm done with college and see how much I was able to borrow and then start making payments then. So again, you need more liquidity. And one of the things we didn't talk about is how much you have saved in emergency reserves. That's really important for somebody your age, especially who's also buying a co-op.
Yeah,
do you have an emergency account?
I do. It's like $3,000.
Okay. So again,
okay.
Now
nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, nothing to sneeze at. But again, it's at this point, what I'd like him to do is not focus so much on the retirement, because he's still going to be putting money in the retirement plan, but just maybe a little bit less, and start increasing his liquid investments, more like a brokerage account. I think that would really help him out.
Okay. So if right now I'm putting about 30% of my salary into the tax deferred annuity. That's on top of the New York STRS. If I reduce that to like 15% and then use some of that to pay for school and put that into a brokerage
right.
account,
that'd make a lot of sense. And here's the thing. I would never say that if we were not going to have any money going into the retirement plan, but you've got money going through the state teacher's retirement system, you're going to have money going into your TSA, or tax sheltered annuity, or your tax deferred annuity. And then in the meantime, one of the things I'd like to do is that I think that you're very hypersensitive about not carrying on a lot of debt. And so one of the beautiful things that when you're done with school, or when you're 30, is that we can get those loans paid off as quickly as possible, because you've actually saved some money on the side to get that done. Again, you're going to go back and take a look at the Stafford loan, whether it's subsidized, unsubsidized, and that's going to help you determine and make that decision.
Okay. I believe they're unsubsidized. So you're saying if I were able to save more money now and put it into a brokerage fund, then when I graduate, I can pay off the loans quickly with that money.
Right. You can put in a conservative portfolio, because in the meantime, what's happening is if it's a subsidized loan, you're not going to be paying any interest on those loans until you graduate. And after, you don't even start making payments until about 6 months after you graduate.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, you've got your money that's going to be invested and working for you.
And it's earning money during that time.
Yeah.
And if it's,
I mean, there is some risk associated with it, but.
Right. So you're doing a fantastic job. And again, at 27, you know, kudos to you. Just continue what you're doing. Keep focusing on what you're doing, and you're going to be fine.
All right. Thanks a lot for the advice.
Thank you, Grant.
Take
Thank
care,
you for
Grant.
Calling us. Take care.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And Louis, thank you. Louis Barajas is a certified financial planner. Louis, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
Coming up, so you didn't save anything to pay for college. Don't panic. Ron Lieber from the New York Times rides to the rescue.
The kid needs to know where you stand. The kid needs to know how much money is available, how much money might be available, how much money the parents are able to borrow or willing to borrow. That conversation needs to start pretty early on in high school so the kid has realistic expectations.
That's Around the Corner on Marketplace Money from APM. Frank and uncomfortable now. Women listeners, how much money do you make? And if you have a male partner, does he make more or less? As women have climbed higher into the workforce, our pay has grown. And with that, some pretty complex financial and emotional dynamics emerge. Farnoosh Torabi has written a book about this. It's called When She Makes More, 10 Rules for Breadwinning Women. Thanks for coming back to Marketplace Money.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
Why did you decide to write this book?
Initially, I wanted to write this book to answer my own questions. I'm the breadwinner in my marriage, have always been in our relationship. And while at the beginning it sort of seemed innocuous to me, who cares who's bringing home the bigger paycheck, as our relationship got more serious and as my family got involved and I started to also think about our future together, I realized our relationship had some unique complexities simply because I was the one bringing home a bigger paycheck. And as a journalist, I started to really get fascinated by a lot of the data out there, looking at this as a sort of macro trend where we see women are now 40% of the breadwinners in this country. There have been plenty of media reports on the trend, plenty of great books, but nothing really offering these couples solutions. Because as it is, I wasn't alone. There are a lot of complexities, unique ones, facing couples with this particular financial dynamic that go unspoken. And I wanted to sort of bring them to surface.
You tell a story about when you tell your mother, I'm gonna be the breadwinner here. Describe it for me.
She was less than optimistic. I believe her exact response was, I just hope you don't have to struggle. I think what she was concerned about wasn't so much where we were currently in our relationship. Who cares when you're just two people? I didn't really appreciate her forecast at the time. But now, of course, having our first kid soon in June, I can see where I'm anticipating being torn, where I know that if we want to maintain our lifestyle the way that I've constructed it, thanks to my income, that it's going to take, you know, just being that hamster on the wheel, that I may not be able to slow it down as much as I'd like in order to pay more attention to my family. It's kind of, we'll see how it goes.
Some people might look at this book and think it is only for rich women or women at the top of the income scale. You're shaking your head.
It's not. In fact, I wanted to make that clear from the very beginning, and it's in the very first few pages of the book, that sure, there are women out there, the Sheryl Sandbergs, who are making great money, who are making above six figures, well-educated, and they certainly comprise part of this demographic. But let's not also forget that there are single mothers that comprise this demographic. And then there are working class families. And frankly, you may not be the breadwinner right now in your relationship, the female breadwinner, but that could change. And we've seen that happen unexpectedly for women in this country, especially during the recession, and still maintaining that role. I think it's been especially challenging for couples who didn't anticipate the financial dynamic flipping.
What are your 10 rules?
Well, you'll have to read the book to know all the 10 rules. But I would say my favorite rules in this book, if I had to pick three, one is level the financial playing field. I talk about money early on in the book. I think that money has always been a point of contention in relationship, but when she makes more, the stakes are higher. Money can sometimes wrongfully equal power. And if she's holding the bigger paycheck, it can easily make the man feel less than, like he's not providing, like he's emasculated. It's not her fault, but it's something certainly to recognize. And there are ways to financially address that, to level the financial playing field, but also to address the emotions. And all the tips are in that chapter. Cater to the Male Brain, a controversial chapter, perhaps.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Really, that's about respecting the relationship. It's respecting and understanding that your male partner has male specific needs in the way that he likes to be communicated to. And this is all stuff that I've learned from relationship experts and behavioral experts and therapists, that broadly speaking, you know, men are men, women are women. And just as we women like to be communicated to in a specific way to feel engaged and to feel like we want to step up and help, men have similar vocabulary that they'd like to hear, a certain way of asking them to do things. So if you want to make your life easier as a breadwinning woman, and you want to make your husband feel more like a provider, help him feel more like a provider, this chapter offers some tools. And then I love the chapter on domestic drudgery and how to avoid that. It's called Buy Yourself a Wife. The point there being that, you know, as breadwinning women, surveys show that we actually take on more housework than women who make less. I think psychologically, we feel that we need to still maintain some semblance of the olden days, and to sort of, you know, the domestic domain has forever, has been up until now, even still, led by women. You can't go through your life, though, you know, juggling work and work, focusing on the paycheck, and then coming home to deal with, you know, cleaning toilets. It's just not going to work out. You're going to burn out. So this chapter talks about how to manage the housework in such a way that feels equitable. It's not about getting to 50-50, but how to feel like you're putting in what you feel is right and fair, and what your partner feels is right and fair. And whatever either of you doesn't want to manage or take care of, how to outsource it affordably.
Farnoosh Torabi is the author of When She Makes More, 10 Rules for Breadwinning Women. Thanks so much, Farnoosh.
Thanks, Lizzie.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. We talk a lot on this show about the rising cost of college and how to plan and save for it. But sometimes life just doesn't work out that way. And now you or your child got into school, but you don't know how to pay for it. Ron Lieber wrote about that this week in a story called 8 Tips for Parents Who Have Saved Nothing for College. He's the Your Money columnist for The New York Times. Welcome back to Marketplace Money.
Good to be here.
Why did you decide to write this article?
Well, we were doing a whole bunch of stories around college and sending kids off to college and the themes around that on the Motherlode blog this week. And one of the most moving essays that came up was one by a mother in Maine who has 6 kids and had not saved barely a cent for college. And she really seemed kind of down on herself. And I thought, you know what? This person almost certainly has nothing to apologize for. And I want to find a way both to say that, but also to offer some practical advice for what is likely to be an increasing number of people who are going to find themselves in similar situations going forward.
So what are your 8 tips if you haven't saved anything for college?
Well, I think for starters, you need to stop apologizing. If you have not been able to save anything for your child's education, it is probably because you've been spending an awful lot of money along the way making sure that child has a decent place to live, has a good school to go to, enriching activities and things for the family to do together. If you've been doing a good job of that, your child is probably well-adjusted and is going to find a way to get to and through college one way or the other. So you should not be apologizing to the kid. You don't even know what the future holds at that point. So, you know, my first advice is just to stop beating yourself up about whatever state your savings balance might be at the moment.
You have one of your rules as no secrets.
So we have a real problem, us parents here in the world, around silence and money in families. And it happens for any number of reasons. Some parents want to protect their kids from however much money the family has or the lack thereof. And other people think it's impolite to talk about money in politic, that it's something that's just not done. And I find this to be intensely problematic for all sorts of reasons, but it's especially bad as you get towards college. The kid needs to know where you stand. The kid needs to know how much money is available, how much money might be available, how much money the parents are able to borrow or willing to borrow. That conversation needs to start pretty early on in high school so the kid has realistic expectations. And so I just think parents shouldn't be keeping secrets by the time certainly a child is ready to apply for college.
So let's say you haven't saved money. What are some ways to get it?
Well, there are a couple ways at this. If your child is a reasonably good student, you know, above average or way above average in your community, there is a chance, it's not a likelihood, but there's a chance that certain schools will be willing to discount their tuition an awful lot to get your child in. If your child is a great student or has some other fantastic talent, your child may bring the averages up at the schools where they're applying. So, you know, this is not a guarantee. Some parents feel like, well, if they can't pay, that they're entitled to some sort of discount or some kind of huge scholarship. But it may well be the case that if your kid has the ability to get into a top 25 private school, that a top 75 private school might discount the tuition so much with what is known as merit scholarships that the price will be much less than it would be to go to your state flagship university. So right away, you're getting the price down maybe to $10,000, $20,000 a year instead of what might be $25,000 or $45,000 or $65,000.
We've talked in the past on this show about how some kids are served better by not going straight to college. How do you handle that conversation?
Well, I think you may want to start that conversation by talking about what a great thing it can actually be for the kid. I mean, college is wasted on most 18-year-olds. It's incredibly expensive. We're talking about tens of thousands of dollars a year spent on, you know, 18-year-old teenagers who are cut loose from home for the first time, often without many bearings or, you know, sort of survival skills on their own. And they're sort of, you know, meandering through these very expensive schools for a year or two before they get their heads screwed on straight. Now imagine a teenager who has taken a year or two off before college. They've gotten a sense of what life looks like in the real world, and they come to the classroom with all of that experience kind of set to put it to bear on whatever it is they're learning. They're usually milking way more out of that first year than an 18-year-old would be. And oh, by the way, when it comes time to apply for jobs later, if you're an employer, you're going to look at somebody who's taken a year or two off and gotten some real world experience a lot differently than you're going to look at somebody who went straight through and maybe worked at a couple of day camps or scooped ice cream during the summer.
Why do you think this issue has struck such a deep, almost raw chord with your readers?
Well, I think in the words of the great personal finance sketch artist Carl Richards, money equals feelings. And it evokes especially strong feelings here because we're talking about our children and how we launch them into the world and whether we've done enough and whether we could have done more. And no matter how much we do, we're almost always going to kick ourselves or question or second guess because, you know, these are the beings that we put on the planet or cared for from a very early age. And so it just makes a mess of your emotions. And, you know, the other tricky thing about this is that very, very, very few parents can actually save enough ahead of time to write a check for a public university tuition and room and board, let alone a private school that now costs more than $250,000 for 4 years. And so people get to the starting line, you know, when the student is a freshman in college, and even if they have half the money saved, they start to feel like, well, did we do something wrong? Did we spend too much on ourselves? And people are kicking themselves, and they just need to stop. The system is what it is, and, you know, you have to muddle through just as best as you can.
Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for The New York Times. Thank you so much, Ron.
Thanks for having me.
How much did your upbringing influence the way you spend? Each week, we turn over the mic to hear a story about how family shapes the way we live money. Today, a blogger and reality show star listens to her mother. Well, eventually. And finally saves up enough money to quit her day job.
My name is Demetria Lucas, and I'm a blogger at A Bell in Brooklyn. And people might know me from a reality show I was on Bravo called Blood, Sweat, and Heels. Grew up in PG County, Maryland. It's a suburb about 15 minutes outside of D.C. A lot of black professionals and a very middle-class sort of area. Sort of like a Leave It to Beaver black version. My parents always talked about saving. You know, I had an allowance. My mother was very... She taught me to put the 10% away, so I think that was important. My dad would always talk about my grandmother. She was from Mississippi, and she lived on a farm. And when she passed away, she'd saved, like, some ungodly sum of money, and no one knew where it came from. And my father would always tell me, it's not about getting a big lump sum. It's about doing a little bit over time. And he'll always point to your grandmother, like, look what she was able to do. I think, like everyone who comes out of college and gets their first job, they kind of go a little crazy. They're not used to having money. My mom did tell me, like, my very first paycheck, she reminded me of that 10% lesson. You know, I heard her and it went in one ear and out the other. But I think once you find yourself in a financial bind, you realize that you've got to do something different if you don't want to find yourself in that position again. So after the first maybe year or so, I smartened up. I cut back on spending. I cut back on the extra nights out, and I would cook, which was new for me because that's not my favorite thing to do then or now. People had birthday parties. I remember one of my really good friends, it was his 30th birthday, and, you know, it was a big shebang, and he was having a $70 all-you-could-drink and all-you-could-eat champagne brunch at this really fancy place, and $70 for a brunch was way out of my budget. It was an experience that I definitely wanted to have, but I just couldn't. And I remember I ran into him at Lord & Taylor, actually, in the city, and I was actually returning something, and he had all these bags, and he was like, oh, well, you're going to come to my party on, you know, Sunday, and I was like, actually, I won't be able to make it. You know, I've been meaning to tell you, but I can't swing it right now. He was like, well, why can't you just put it on your credit card? And I was like, well, my credit card's for emergencies. And he was like, my birthday doesn't count? It's a very different way of looking at spending money. In 2011, I published my first book, and I was still working a full-time job. I was a relationship editor at Essence Magazine, and also had a nice cushion from all that money I'd been saving. I'd stepped up my mother's idea of 10% to maybe like 20 or 30 at that point. Like, I was really, really careful with my money because I had an idea in the back of my head that I wouldn't work full time anymore and that I would really branch out and become an entrepreneur. I decided I needed to, like, leave my job to really pursue my blog and my book to the best of my ability. And because I had a nice savings, I was able to do that.
Demetria Lucas blogs at A Bell in Brooklyn. Her forthcoming book is called Don't Waste Your Pretty, the go-to guide for making smarter decisions in life and love. Send us your own lessons in family finance or tweet us at LiveMoney or record your story at MarketplaceMoney.org. That's Marketplace Money today. A quick note before we end. You'll hear guest hosts David Lazarus and Barbara Bogave over the next few weeks. I'll be taking some time to work on our exciting new show called Marketplace Weekend. We hope you'll join us when we roll out that show on June 28th. Marketplace Money is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Candice Manriquez. Our senior producer is Dan Semitovich. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. And thanks for listening.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.